Senate members, calling all Senate members for a subcommittee on human services. Today is Wednesday, February 28th. We are going to have what I promise you is a great hearing today. And if we get to the point where the room is full, there is an overflow room in 357. 357 will be an overflow room if people come in while the hearing is going on. So make sure you help us out if it gets to be real full and tell people 357 is the overflow room. Overflow room. Thank you. I would like to open the hearing today on House Bill 5031, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I'd like to transfer this hearing until tomorrow, hearing on 5031, and close that hearing for today. We will have a public hearing and potential work session on House Bill 2201 relating to Oregon Healthy Kids Program. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to invite the Executive Department, Erin Kelly Seale, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and Rocky King to the podium with us.
Good afternoon, Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seale, and I am the Governor's Human Services Policy Advisor.
Erin, before you get started,
yes, ma'am.
May I ask, and I will have to stop you at one point again when the Senate members arrive. What I'd like to have happen as a matter of expediency is that we allow each person to complete their presentation, and at the close of their presentation, you ask questions. Okay? At the close of each individual's presentation, then you can ask questions. I'd appreciate your cooperation on that piece. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.
Bruce Goldberg, the Director of the Department of Human Services.
Hi, and I'm Rocky King. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships.
Members of the committee, Chair Carter, today what we thought we would do is focus on House Bill 2201 and the programmatic elements of the proposed Healthy Kids Plan that are reflected in the governor's budget. There will be some discussion, I understand, a little bit later about the bill and some of the changes that have been made on the House side. But I was asked to just be certain that folks had an understanding of what we proposed in terms of the program and its elements and some of the dynamics around the funding. This proposal is a proposal to cover all uninsured Oregon children up to age 19. According to the data that we released in 2004, which is recently being updated, there are about 117,000 children in Oregon without insurance. The proposal is to provide a comprehensive health benefit to those children that includes dental, vision, mental health, and physical health care. And the proposal is, at its most simple element, building on existing programs that we have already in the state, the Oregon Health Plan, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and it does create a new product, which I'll talk about in a moment, but it really uses the administrative structure that is already in place in the state, providing health insurance to around 225,000 children already in Oregon, rather than inventing a new agency or a new structure from which to operate the program. The vision for the program is at its core really focused on children and families and creating a program that is simple for families to get into and that eliminates any differential really between families who are low income and are on the Oregon Health Plan and families who are in middle income families, to the degree that what we'd like to provide them is a single card that really just basically says your child can access health care. There are differentials, of course, in terms of shared responsibility for families, which we'll also get into a little bit later. But on its face, what we were really hoping to achieve is a program that, for families, was easily accessible, but also really streamlined in terms of what families had in their hands and their ability to access health care. The proposal and the program reflected in House Bill 2201 maintains the structure. It meets kids' health care needs really in three ways. First, it expands opportunities to children in middle-income families whose incomes are too high to qualify for the Oregon Health Plan today, but who are struggling to afford health insurance. About 91% of the uninsured children are in families with working parents. And one of the fastest growing groups of uninsured are working Oregonians. And so this proposal really is designed to meet those families halfway and help them to afford health care and really to make that health care more affordable. The program is also designed to improve and expand access to kids who are already eligible for the Oregon Health Plan but are not enrolled. As we look deeper into the number of children without insurance in the state, we learned that about half of them are eligible for but not enrolled in the existing program. And we asked some questions about why that is. We found out that the way the program's currently designed, there are some barriers to families enrolling their children in the program. We really aren't reaching out to families today and telling them about the program. Our application is very complicated. It's currently 11 pages long in terms of what people are being asked to fill out. We also require people to re-enroll in the current program every 6 months. And every time that re-enrollment period expires and a family doesn't sign up under the current program, they have to be uninsured again for 6 months before they can get back into the program. So we wanted to eliminate those barriers as we put this program together and really improve and expand access to those children who should be in our programs today but aren't. And then we also wanted to be certain that as we had a conversation about providing health insurance to all children, that we did not lose the focus on the issue around actually being able to access medical care. Just because you have an insurance card doesn't necessarily mean that you are able to see a physician or able to get the eyeglasses that you need. And so there are some components to what the governor proposed that are designed to address the issue of access, not just insurance for every child. The structure of the program that is in House Bill 2201 essentially maintains the Oregon Health Plan program for kids in families with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. And the advantage that gives to those very low-income families is that they not only get the comprehensive benefit that we're proposing to give to all kids in the Healthy Kids Plan, but they also do not have co-pays or monthly premiums that they have to pay. This is consistent with our current program. Today, we cover kids and families up to 185% of the federal poverty level. This would grow that to 200% of the federal poverty level in the proposal and maintain the policy around cost sharing for those new children enrolled. The proposal is also to continue the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. That's our program that offers subsidies to families to buy private health insurance coverage either through their employer under a group model or individual coverage when their employer doesn't participate in the program. And so for those families whose children are currently enrolled in FEAP, they would be able to have a choice about maintaining that enrollment so there could be consistency among their family members, parents, and children about who is enrolled in the FEAP subsidy program. That's what I think for FEAP. The last and really new element to the program is what we call the private insurance product, which would be a new option for those families I mentioned. Really half of the uninsured children are in working families that this would apply to with incomes at 200% of the federal poverty level and above. The proposal is to create a program that, again, provides that comprehensive benefit package to those families that gives them some assistance about what plan to choose, but that creates a shared responsibility model for those families to purchase this insurance product for themselves based on their income. The issue of affordability, I've already hit on a little bit, but when we went around the state, and really we need to pay credit to the Medicaid Advisory Committee, who hosted town halls with families statewide to get a better assessment directly from them about what they could afford. This issue of affordability was the focus of those discussions, and we learned a lot from the families themselves about what would work best for them in terms of providing coverage through a shared responsibility model. We learned that that they appreciate the predictability of paying a monthly premium as opposed to having a change every month in terms of what they might be responsible for in terms of healthcare costs. And then we also took a hard look at the issue of how much money families have at the end of the month to buy healthcare. A lot of focus has been paid to yearly incomes and where people fall on the federal poverty level, and that's certainly an important issue for us in terms of eligibility determination. But in terms of the discussion about what's actually affordable, we did an economic analysis with Oregon-specific data looking separately at rural communities and urban communities, and calculated after families have bought what we would consider to be essentials, housing, have paid for housing, have paid for transportation costs so that they can go to work, have paid for their child care for their children, have paid for food and some clothing, how much at the end of the month with those expenses in each community can a family at various income levels really expect to have left to buy health care? And what we found out is that it's really not until families are between 200 and the next slide will show 250% of the federal poverty level living at those income levels that they have income at the end of the month to use to buy health care. And I think you have to remember that a lot of these families are already paying on average $11,000 a year for their own family health care premiums, or would be if they were buying health care for themselves as adults. So I did hand out today the 2007 federal poverty level information, which these slides have not been updated to reflect, but I thought it would be helpful for folks just to have in hand a chart which the Office of Private Health Partnerships put together looking at that yearly income and what it is that families are making either annually, monthly, or hourly based on family size. As I mentioned, it was a little different as we looked at urban and rural families. Urban families, we found, were having a little bit of a harder time making ends meet up until about 250% of the federal poverty level. And what we heard from the folks that when we did these town halls was that the state's estimates around the cost of living were very conservative, and that, in fact, we had underestimated the true cost for them to afford things. For example, in the category of child care, the assumption was that one child was school-aged and the other child was four. Well, I have a child who's under the age of two in child care, and the cost for her is much greater than the cost for a four-year-old in child care. And if you had two children in child care, that cost would double, which would significantly impact, obviously, the amount of disposable income at the end of the month a family would have. So every family looks different. Every community is different. But we felt like this was a good baseline from which to start the conversation about affordability. So the proposal that is reflected in the governor's budget is this. And again, these dollar figures in terms of annual incomes have not been updated to reflect the 2007 numbers. I apologize. It's on my to-do list to do that for this chart. But these are the 2006 income levels that the federal government had put out around FPL. And what this shows is really what I talked about in terms of the shared responsibility. How much would it cost a family at a particular income level to afford health care? And in the governor's budget, what's being proposed, as I mentioned earlier, that up to 200% of the federal poverty level, that represents about 68,000 children. Those children would be enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan and would have the Oregon Health Plan benefit. They would then also not have a cost every month in terms of their health care costs. For families above 200%, you can see that the state contribution goes down as income levels get higher, and the family contribution goes up. This slide is designed to reflect when the state would be able to maximize the federal revenue available to us, and we will be able to apply for a federal waiver to draw down federal match for families up to 300% of the federal poverty level. And so you can see here that above 300% of the federal poverty level, any subsidy would be state-only funded, but also then supported by that family contribution. We also, I'll breeze through these quickly, included funding in the budget to do a better job around outreach and to partner with local communities around that issue. In particular, we had some really good conversations with underserved communities, both communities of color as well as rural communities, children in rural communities as well as communities. Both, what I mean by underserved is that those children often are not enrolled in health programs, and even more often are not, if they are enrolled, they're not getting access to care. And we wanted to be sure when we did this when we initiated this outreach effort that we were paying special attention to those issues for those communities and what they may need that look different than a community outreach program for another group in another area of the state. We also are proposing to make some changes to reduce those barriers I talked about earlier. We've got a draft 2-page application coming down from 11 pages. We would propose to extend the enrollment period to 12 months, which is consistent with what the private insurance products that we all participate in allow. We would also maintain an insurance requirement but reduce it from 6 months to 2. And this is really designed to allow us in the first years of the Healthy Kids Plan to focus on children who do not have insurance as opposed to children who do. But I will tell you that in the budget assumptions that were constructed underlying the governor's budget, there is an assumption, and we base this on the experience in other states that had pretty expansive coverage programs for children, that there would be about 3% of children who are currently covered through employer-sponsored programs may come on to the Healthy Kids Plan. It's a very, very small number of kids. In most states' experience, there are some states that have had zero children move from a private program to a public program, and the highest the state with the highest percentage that we could find, and this is we know this because the federal government requires this reporting every year, was 5%. So we thought 3% was a safe estimation, and we included that in the pricing for the program. Finally, there's an asset test that we currently have for our CHIP program of $10,000, and we are proposing to eliminate it. And that's really because by the time the families come forward with all the paperwork that they need to demonstrate what assets they do or don't have, and we verify it, there aren't very many families that have more than $10,000 worth of assets that would be accessing this program. And in terms of cost benefit to the state for administering that particular element versus the benefit to families of eliminating it, we are proposing to eliminate it. The last piece is in the governor's budget also is included funding for more school-based health centers designed specifically to meet kids where they are in schools and provide an access point for them. We also are proposing to expand a dental sealant program. Dental health is actually one of the most significant challenges kids in Oregon are facing today, and there are some really cost-effective, preventive measures that we could take as a state to improve children's dental health, and we can do that by expanding on a program we already have that, again, meets kids where they are in communities and in schools and prevents dental caries. And then finally, we want to be sure that kids in this program have access to the right care at the right place. And one way to do that is to give families the opportunity to call a nurse advice line and check in on whatever the condition is that their child may be suffering from and ask the question, do I need to see a doctor? Do I need to go to the emergency room? And so we included a nurse advice line component to the program to make sure that that resource was available to families. Around the issue of funding, the program, as I mentioned already, proposes to maximize the use of federal dollars to the state. We think we've put something together that really efficiently and effectively uses our state dollars. And we are, of course, proposing to increase the tobacco tax to be equal to that of Washington State to support the state portion of funding for this expansion of the program. And then it's important, I think, to remember that half of the families participating in the program will also be contributing financially to it by paying part of that monthly premium and also by paying co-pays under the private insurance products that we contract for. The other piece of paper that I handed out, this is probably just a good time to just tell you what that is. You can see what this piece of paper and table is designed to illustrate is exactly what the governor's budget assumes with respect to the tobacco tax revenue and what the and what we would use it for. In 07-09, you can see that the estimate that we have legislative revenue has confirmed is that we would have approximately $182 million in new tobacco tax revenue after accounting for some of the loss and other programs that would happen as a result of reduced consumption. We would have $182 million net revenue to spend. We included in the governor's budget about 1% of that revenue going to the Department of Revenue to do enforcement of the tax to monitor internet sales and cross-border sales, etc. Then the components that are next outlined are the Healthy Kids Plan, and the budget for the plan is split between both the Department of Human Services. Of course, their funding is what would be going toward administration of the eligibility component, basically, and also to fund those children who are under 200% of the federal poverty level that aren't enrolled in the program today. And then to the Office of Private Health Partnerships, which would be providing the subsidy to families in the private insurance product, as well as administering the outreach and marketing program associated with the Healthy Kids Plan. And then there is an additional investment in school-based health centers, which will allow us to bring 13 new centers online before the end of the biennium. The governor's budget assumes that 10% of that new revenue would go to the tobacco use prevention account. I know you're going to hear more about that later, so I won't spend time there. But we also spent the additional revenue that was available from this revenue source on some other important programs, many of which, in fact, all of which are related to health care for kids in one way or another. The Healthy Teen Survey is an important data source for the state in terms of what's actually happening with young people around a variety of risk factors as well as strengths. This is information that we count on to build our budgets and make policy recommendations to you regularly. The early assessment and support teams is a critical piece of investment in our mental health care system. It focuses on early intervention for children who have their first psychotic break, children and young people. It's a proven program that is actually operating today in and around Marion County and has had some great results intervening early with young people, meeting their families' needs, keeping them in school and helping them get employed and keeping them out of our state hospital system. So it's really an excellent prevention program. The juvenile diabetes database is simply another data point which we thought had a direct connection to healthy kids in a lot of ways and would make sense to fund here. We also know that one of the things directly connected to the issue of access is what the state pays providers. And so you'll see a few investments here directly related to our payments for both hospitals as well as physicians. And that's really, again, just about making sure that when we offer a program that people can actually access the care and getting back to really the basis of the Oregon Health Plan, or starting to. It doesn't go all the way, but originally that program was designed to reimburse providers fully for the cost of their care. Because we haven't been doing that in the last several years, costs are shifted to the private insurance that we all buy, and so this is an investment to try to reverse that trend. There's also a significant investment here in the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program, and that would allow the state to grow that program by 10 to 15,000 individuals. This is part of the broader vision, and I think there are several members on this committee that are committed to this, that healthy kids for the governor really is just the start of the discussion we believe we need to be having as a state about providing health coverage to all Oregonians. And investing in the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program allows us to really start that and go beyond just an investment in children that really invest in adults and some of their parents as well. It's also a critical component to the mental health discussion. One of the things that we know is that a lot of our communities have been struggling with that issue around getting folks access to mental health care in communities, again, avoiding hospital-level care. And OHP standard is critical to that goal, as well as to the goal of getting folks into addiction treatment and recovery services earlier rather than later. So that's the budget at a high level that the governor invests in the first biennium, and then the second biennium, what you can see is that the tobacco tax increase proposed will fully sustain the cost of the Healthy Kids program, but we acknowledge that we would need to have discussion with you all in the long run about some of those other investments that the governor makes in his budget relative to this particular revenue source. So in summary, we've put together a program which we're very grateful to the committee for considering that looks at providing the opportunity for the 117,000 uninsured kids today to get insurance, but also have access and meet their health care needs in a way that we think is really an excellent long-term investment for the state. So with that, I'll take questions, Madam Chair.
Questions? John, our committee administrator.
Just a point of clarification, members, and that is that this list is a list of how the tobacco tax, the net increase in tobacco tax, is used in the governor's budget. But I would point out that the items toward the bottom of the page, healthy teen survey and so on, are not specifically mentioned in House Bill 2201. However, they are part of the governor's recommended budget. Likewise, the school-based health centers, again, is not specifically mentioned in House Bill 2201, but it, too, is part of the governor's recommended budget. So just that point of clarification.
May I remind you, members, that we are discussing the 2201A engrossed, and I'd like for our questions to be confined to that or too confined to what the speaker has said. Let's start on my left and come down with Representative Kotek or whoever else knows. After that, I don't have to call you. You can just ask the questions and we'll go to the Senate.
Well, thank you. Just a clarification. Thank you, Aaron, for the presentation. one of the things I think is great about the plan is it builds on what we're already doing. I just want to clarify, because some people have asked me, but I keep telling them that I just want to make sure. We're still talking about covering kids up to 200% of poverty in the existing Oregon Health Plan or in FEOP. That is still the plan. Is that true?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, yes.
Great, thank you. And the other thing I want to mention is just put a pitch in for the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, because some people might not be too familiar with that. Because it is, we are actually required by the federal government to collect some of this information. And not only does the state need it, but a lot of our nonprofit partners depend on this data to leverage grant dollars, additional federal funds. It is our primary data source for knowing what's happening with our teens in the state. So it's about time we have some sustainable funding for it. So I just wanted to put a plug on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three specific questions. I'll just say them all at one time,
okay,
to simplify this. The first question, the Department of Revenue costs, I believe you mentioned that was for enforcement. Does that include, then, Department of Revenue payments to the Department of Justice? The second question is there anything in this plan that specifically addresses nutrition? And the third question is, I would like to learn a little more about the line where hospital equity appears.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, I'm going to ask Dr. Goldberg to answer your last two questions, and then I will answer your first. I'll do my best to.
Regarding nutrition and the equity issue, I think one of the tenets of the Healthy Kids Plan is to not just get kids health insurance, but to get them access to health care. And that means having children have a medical home, being able to be certain they get the kind of preventive services that they need. And certainly, nutritional issues are part of a comprehensive health care plan. And indeed, for many children on the Oregon Health Plan now, when they have issues and problems that are related to nutritional issues, that coverage is provided. So it's really related to the child as well as the condition. In regard to the DRG equity piece, we pay hospitals in the Oregon Health Plan in two different ways. We pay our rural hospitals cost-based reimbursement. They get paid for the cost of the care that they deliver. For our urban hospitals, those are our DRG hospitals, generally the larger hospital facilities up and down the Willamette Valley, Portland, Eugene, Salem, Medford. Those are what we refer to as our DRG hospitals. It's the way that they're paid. In fee-for-service, in reimbursing those hospitals, we pay a percentage of that DRG rate. It's a diagnostic related group, and it varies substantially from hospital to hospital. We may pay, for instance, one hospital for the diagnosis of taking care of a ruptured appendix, 50% of the DRG rate, and to another hospital we pay 72%. The same service, taking someone's appendix out, but yet it's a reflection of a historical way that we've done our payments. What that investment tries to do is begin to raise the floor so that we create some equity. And what we've always tried to do in the Oregon Health Plan, and hopefully we'll get back to, is we pay the cost of care, and we try and pay that equitably across the state. And that investment doesn't get us all the way there. It only gets us, I think it brings somewhere in the vicinity of 8 to 10 of the lowest hospitals halfway up to the highest.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, I had an email from the director of our Department of Revenue, Elizabeth Harshenko, giving me a quick outline of what the dollars would be invested in, and I didn't bring it, but I will do my best to answer your question, and I'll have her follow up with you if that's okay. This $1.7 million is really part of a larger investment that we already make about 1% of all of our tobacco tax revenue today, and this just continues that, goes toward the enforcement efforts on the part of Department of Revenue, and they engage in those enforcement efforts in partnerships with state police and the Department of Justice. And so my understanding is that, yes, what this would do is add to that pot of dollars, if you will, and be supporting the effort, the collaborative effort across those various agencies that work on the enforcement issue. But I will be sure that that Elizabeth Harshenko follows up with both you and with John Britton to make sure that my answer is in fact accurate.
Down the line. Come down.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be speaking on behalf of the minorities of Oregon that are going to be taxed to help fund this program, which I think is unfair to tax a minority of Oregonians to fund a wide encompassing program such as this, although the program concept no one can argue with. Why did you include a cigarette tax in funding this bill rather than just general fund?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, today in Oregon already, the majority of us who do not smoke are paying the health care costs for those who do. And the information that we have suggests that our tax on cigarettes would need to be somewhere over $11 per pack in order for us to really recoup the costs that we already pay for smokers in our system, in our health care system. And so we felt that there is a direct connection to making an investment in children and to investing in what we really view as a health program, which is the cigarette tax. the benefit of that tax goes beyond generating additional revenue to support health care. What it will do is it will help us keep kids from starting to smoke. The estimate is that at the current level proposed, 29,400 youth would not smoke as a result of the increased price of cigarettes. It will incentivize people to quit. And so that reduced consumption in the end actually saves all of us money, particularly the Oregon Health Plan, actually. And so we feel that there is a direct connection between the cost of health care and people who smoke, and felt like it was appropriate to increase that particular revenue source as we try to increase the number of people in the state who have health care access.
So you're already projecting declining income from cigarettes?
That's included in the pricing that is here before you. Yes, there is anticipated reduced consumption of cigarettes, and we worked with Legislative Revenue Office as well as, you know, through our Department of Revenue to include those estimates and make sure those effects were taken into account. We actually took them into account twice over, if you will. We looked at both the effect of the price increase on consumption, and then we also looked at the effect of enhancing the investment in our prevention programs. And so together we came up with a factor that legislative revenue agreed was very reasonable, estimated that reduced consumption as part of the revenue forecast, and that's what you have before you.
One more follow-up. So if you take this out far enough, you have declining revenues from the tobacco tax, but you're going to have increasing health costs of this program. Somewhere down the line, those two have to intersect.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, I'm really glad that you made that point, because I think when you look at all of our health care programs, that exact effect is happening, whether we're funding them with general fund or the tobacco tax. The health care costs today are growing at a much faster rate than both our revenue that we're generating from the income tax or any revenue that we could generate from the tobacco tax. And so, again, as part of the larger vision for this program, we are supportive of the discussions that are going on about how we finance health care in this state more broadly. And we anticipate that those conversations will intersect with the Healthy Kids program somewhere far out down the line, just as we, you know, our current funding for health care as a country is not sustainable. And so we really need to be sure that we focus on it, and I'm glad that you brought it up.
Thank you for your candid response.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Colasio, help me understand.
Representative Morgan, can you hold for just 1 minute?
Okay.
Senator Bates would like to help answer the last question. And please, you guys, once your other partner has gotten through, just go on down the line, please. Senator Bates.
Representative Garrard asked a very good question, but I'd like to throw a little more information back to answer that. If we could disaggregate out the cost of secondhand smoke on the cost of children's health care and premature deliveries as a result of women who smoke during pregnancy, it would be far and away above the cigarette tax. If you just decide to put the cigarette tax just for the actual cost of smoking in this population, it would just be way beyond this. Okay, I mean, but we can't disaggregate it. There's no way we can get to that number. We know the overall number is $4 to $5 per pack of cigarettes to the cost of health care. And that's what we have to put the tax on, just to cover overall health costs. But if you can just segregate the cost for that with the kids, it would be way above this. And we all know that, but we can't give you the exact number. And I will predict something else. What you're looking at, when you have these two numbers crisscrossing, you know, as tobacco revenue hopefully goes down because there are less people smoking, but costs keep driving up. Clearly, it's part of the entire system has to be changed. But here's one of the things you have to consider also. When you stop you from smoking, the benefit as far as cost to health care isn't immediate. It's 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road before that benefit is seen in the healthcare system as far as cost and health is concerned. But the quitting smoking, of course, is seen right now as far as the tax is concerned. So you've got these lines intersecting here. I think out in 20 years, they're going to intersect again as the benefit of people not smoking starts dropping healthcare costs back down again. So it's a win-win in the long run. It can be looked kind of strange in the short run. And so those two issues have to be kept in back of our minds when we deal with this thing. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, could I respond just with one comment?
It's quarter to two. We got to 2:30. I'm sorry, Representative Gore. I'd love to have the national board. Just never argue with the doctor.
I'm not going to pile on.
Just a couple of nuts and bolts questions to help me understand this, because I have not had much exposure to this program at all before now. 117 children uninsured now. What was the number that were currently eligible for OHP?
About half of that number. When you look back at the chart that shows the under 200% of federal poverty level, the number shows 68,000, but there are some of those children who aren't currently eligible today because we only cover families up to kids and families up to 185. So our estimate is that around 60,000 children would currently be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan today.
And I believe you said that you had also done some quantitative work on what it was that was keeping those kids from being enrolled in the program. And I heard you say things around the complexity of the program, but I didn't know what else you said in relation to that.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan. The Office of Health Policy and Research did a study, and I'd be happy to provide you with it if you're interested, that showed really three things that were related to that created barriers. One was the complexity of the application. We have a long application today. It's 11 pages, and it's simply, I mean, it's been interesting to, we've handed it out to folks, and even folks like myself have gotten discouraged around page 5. The second issue is the way that we have handled the issue of re-enrollment. To date, we require families to re-enroll every 6 months, and then on top of that, we also have a six-month uninsurance period requirement in the current program. And so did I miss anything in the study?
And the other issue is outreach.
Oh, that we're not really actively seeking to enroll people in the program today, and so there are a lot of people who simply don't know about it. And that issue relates also directly to another finding that the report made, which is that there's some confusion among families when parents aren't eligible for the program, that their children may not also be. And so in the case of when we lost coverage under Oregon Health Plan standard in 2003, many people thought then that their children would no longer be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and so chose not to re-enroll their children when, in fact, their children still were eligible.
The issues around the way that the application is configured and the six-month rotation through the program, and then if you don't re-enroll, you have to be out 6 months, do those relate to the waiver, and why are those the way they are?
Go ahead.
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, the 6 month period is related to the way we've structured and budgeted the program historically, as well as the application, and we could change those. And I think as you know, there's a relationship between the policies that the programs operate under, how they're funded, and our caseload forecasts, which you've been working with us to follow. And what the Healthy Kids Plan does is actually present the opportunity for us to have exactly that discussion and to have the policy discussion about changing that 6 to 12 month enrollment period. We can do that. To do that then also has an effect on the budget and the caseload. And we need to have that explicitly and fund the program to match the intent around changing the application so that we make it easier to get children in. If we put enhanced dollars into outreach, all we need to do is just to be able to budget and manage the programs to the intent that the legislature gives us. So we can do those things. We've never, over the last couple of biennia, had that explicit discussion around some of these issues.
So just to make sure I've got this clear, we do not require a waiver to make those changes. Was that what you said?
I will check on exactly whether we need to get a waiver to make that change or not. I don't know.
Okay, and then I have one more part of thing that I don't understand. Yeah. The tobacco and tax revenue for 07-09 on the sheet that you gave us was $181.7 million. When does that, where in time does that get implemented over the biennium?
The estimates are based on a November implementation date of the new tax increase, and the program estimates are based on a January 1, 2008 start date for the program.
So the tax increase starts November of 07?
Yes.
Okay, and the enrollment is November of 08.
January.
Oh, January of 08. Okay, and so the revenue then will be collected for 2 months in 07 and all of 08 and half of 09. And then in 09-11, it'll be all through the biennium. So is it possible to tell me, what I want to know is the percentage of increase that, based on the same kind of, if there were two full bienniums of tax collection going on here, what's the implication on the revenue of people not smoking? What I'm trying to get to is what's going to happen in 11-13 when we have two full bienniums, and you've got the implications of that Senator Bates talked about, where the costs and potentially the enrollments go up on the enrollment side, and then on the revenue side you've got potentially less and less smokers, and whether anybody's looked out after the program has been implemented for two full bienniums.
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, I think we would have to circle back with your legislative revenue office to ask them how far out their forecasts around the tobacco tax go. I think, as you've been working with the DHS forecasting group, you know that I think the further out you get, the less certain you are about some of those forecasting issues. And they also would be the ones to apply the expertise around where that decreased consumption levels out, because at some point, the effect of the price increase does actually level itself out. And I don't know if you have any more information on that, Dr. Goldberg.
Okay, so you'll work with Representative Morgan on that piece.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Before Debbie starts, clarification by Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I would note that the dates that Aaron Kelly-Seal mentioned to you about the implementation of the tax have been changed from the original bill and from those assumed in the governor's budget. And they are changed in the enhanced version of the bill. So, and we can get to that in a bit. I also will, when it comes to my turn, I will have a revenue statement for you that was issued by the Legislative Revenue Office.
Relating to the revised version of the
yes,
bill.
Correct, yes.
Excellent.
Just as a matter of time management, colleagues, may I ask you to limit questions a little more, since we have three other people to testify to give us information, and we now only have 50 minutes, 45 minutes to go. Thank you very much.
I'll be really fast, and I will count this for all three of you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is long due primary prevention. It's just a great idea, a great program. It will save a lot of money in the long run, and I think we'll have a healthier population as the result of it. So thank you.
Senator Westman, and down the line from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, let's just be clear about what we're talking about here. We're talking about the most deadly, costly, expensive drug ever introduced into the American society. Street drugs kill 19, 20,000 a year. Tobacco, or excuse me, alcohol, round numbers, 80,000. Tobacco is 400,000 a year. And I hear some of these technical questions being asked, and I fully support getting every piece of legislation as good as we can possibly get it. But I'm concerned that they're being used as not technical questions, but technical reasons not to do the right thing. I'm not part of, you know, taking smoking privileges away from people. I just ask that those costs be equally borne in relation to the expenses they incur. You talk about the state of Oregon and the impact on every budget we have. State of Oregon, the largest purchaser of direct health care in this state. This impacts our school, our drug and alcohol, our judicial system, community corrections, our police departments, mental health. Because an ever-increasing number, percentage of those budgets, health care costs, are rising. And you put it in terms of our ability, not just to compete as a nation, but particularly for our small businesses, those good corporate citizens that are struggling to continue to provide health care costs. The largest single driver of business costs today in this state is health care. That single line item in companies that offer health care is 22 to 24% of payroll with no end in sight. They are paying for those unaccounted for costs incurred by tobacco use. And we can quibble over, you know, what percent goes here in school-based clinics and how many, you know, of our working poor standard population is going to go back in. Those are legitimate questions. But the first question is, are we going to do the right thing? Is this body going to be responsible to all taxpayers and pass the Healthy Kids Plan? I think you know my answer is a resounding yes, and it is time. Let's take politics, put it to the back of the line. Let's put people first. Let's put policy before partisanship. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon, down.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Looking at Section 6 of the bill, lines 27 and 28.
Oh, Senator, can you wait and ask Mr. Bitt? He's the one going to go over the AM roast.
Can you?
I'm prepared to answer that now.
My question, Madam Chair, is what are the options for a child who has not lived in the state for 180 days? Looking at the reading of the language on lines 27 and 28.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley and members, we're looking on page 5 of the A engrossed bill, lines 27 and 28. I would tell you, Senator, that there is a potential or a real problem with this particular requirement that is in 2201-A. We have been advised by legislative counsel that a durational residency is contrary to Medicaid law. Moreover, it is would not probably withstand a constitutional challenge, as similar state laws have been deemed by the United States Supreme Court to violate the constitutional right to travel freely from state to state, and also as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Now, counsel can comment further on that. I'm paraphrasing their response, but this is a problem in the bill.
in direct response to your question, I don't know what other options would be available for a child other than to go to the emergency room or to some other kind of health clinic.
Senator, my plan is that when we go into work session, we're going to have counsel here and everybody else on the more technical issues.
Great, and I would request that we have the legislative counsel opinion, if it's already in the written form, that we have the opportunity to see that.
We'll take care of that
as a committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, thank you. You guys did a lot of work on this, and there's somebody in this room we should recognize that isn't here right now. That's Senator Mons Anderson, who has worked for a year and a half to bring this to us.
Yes.
She loved the governor, and I want to publicly acknowledge the hard work she's done. This bill is extremely important for three reasons. And I have a lot of technical details I can ask you off the record. We can deal with them through amendments or whatnot, but they're not important. The first thing is this is the first step towards universal health care. It's not the final answer, but it's the first step, and we must take that first step in this session, followed by second step, the session of setting up an entity to start reforming health care in a broader sense. Secondly, kids need a medical home. This bill gives them a medical home. I'm tired of seeing kids in emergency rooms. I'm tired of seeing sick kids that haven't got any place to go. It's time for us to take care of the kids in Oregon. You may have some arguments about adults, but kids have no choices in these matters. It's time to take care of Oregon kids. And the third thing is what a good senator from Tumalo just talked about. The biggest epidemic, the biggest driver of health care costs we have in this state is cigarette smoking. It is an epidemic yet. It's a pestilence. It's the worst thing we have. We talk about all the kinds of problems in health care, but if we could just eliminate smoking, I would tell you we wouldn't have a decision to make about access and cost in health care. It would be eliminated. I know we're not going to eliminate smoking with this bill. In Oregon right now, more young people are smoking than used to. We are losing the battle again, and this bill is going to address that. When young people start smoking again, it's very hard to get them to quit. It's a very addictive drug, potentially the most addictive drug in some ways that we have. So the young people who are smoking now are probably going to be smoking for the next 40 years. And then those health care costs are going to come to us and lives will be ruined. This bill addresses that problem. And I think it's more than appropriate that this bill is tied to children's health care for the reason I've already stated. It's time for us to put politics aside. This is not really a partisan issue. Let's just do the right thing and get this bill out, get it across the floor, and show Oregonians that we care about kids and that we want our population to be healthy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. I want to relate a personal experience. We have 8 children. We gave birth to 11 children. After the first child, all of the others except the last two were underweight and premature. We lost 3 premature children who were born and lived a matter of hours in a respirator, an incubator. When we moved from Portland to Eugene, my wife went to Dr. Woodward, who looked at her record and said, and she was pregnant, and he said, I'm not going to deal with you unless you quit smoking. So she did, and the last 2 children that we had were full term and full weight. Now, smoking is devastating on the lives of people. Children are captive in a home where there's smoke. That will have a profound effect on their lives, on their health. So I think this is an extremely important children's bill. Smoking is a children's issue. They have no choice but to be where there's smoke. And for pregnant women, if it's secondhand smoke, that's just as bad. Premature births, loss of life.
I don't know who's next. Dr. Goldberg or Rocky?
I think that concludes our portion of the presentation, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dr. Collins? Mel Collins? Senator Johnson, Senator Johnson, please join us.
Thank you.
Oh.
Senator Malcolm.
Thank you, Senator Carter. For the record, I'm Dr. Malcone. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I was asked to speak to you today about what kind of an investment you would be making in terms of prevention. What kinds of benefits might you actually receive if this plan goes into place as has been proposed? As I started to think about this question, the first thing that I think you need to know is that what you would be investing in is a very effective approach, and we have a good track record to show that. From 1996 to 2004, when the program was in effect and relatively well funded, since over that time period, we've seen 94,000 fewer smokers here in Oregon, a 55% drop in eighth grade smoking. Senator Bates has alluded to the importance of stopping kids from starting to smoke in the first place, and 2.7 billion fewer cigarettes sold annually. But despite these successes, tobacco remains a big problem, again, as has already been noted very eloquently. Almost 20% of adult Oregonians still smoke. We have almost 7,000 deaths a year here in Oregon. That's 22% of our deaths that are due to tobacco. And we estimate that about 20 youth start to smoke each day here in Oregon. This rolls up to over $1 billion in health care costs in the state each year. Okay, so we've got an effective approach. And we still have a problem, nonetheless. So the next point is that how effective we're going to be is related to the decisions that you make about funding. And again, I'm going to go into a little bit of past history here, not to rehash that, but because I think it illustrates the point that when funding is taken away, we lose ground. So this graph shows the annual per capita cigarette consumption in Oregon. Oregon is in the yellow line, and in the United States in the green line. And what you can see that is that in 1997, when the TPEP program started, we were roughly at about the national rate. As the program kicked in, we started to very rapidly decrease the rate of cigarette consumption. In fact, we were dropping at about twice the rate of what was being seen in the rest of the country. In 2003, when the program funds were cut, the slope of that line changed very dramatically. And what you see there is the lines flattening out and maybe even starting to pick up a little bit. Now, these effects don't happen immediately. It's not like you turn off the tap and the water stops. It takes some time for the program gains we had made to be eroded. But I think now that we've got three data points here, three different years of data, it's pretty convincing to me that we're really starting to see those gains eroded.
Dr. Duncan, a question on your data so far.
Can you go back to the last slide? What's the dollar gap represented between that low point in 03 and the national average? I see the packs per capita. What would be the dollar gap? I'm reading this slide incorrectly. I better put my glasses on. Hold that question.
Okay.
Thank you.
So here's another example, and you know, Senator Morissette spoke very eloquently about his own experiences with babies who were born to moms who smoke. This graph shows the percentage of births to mom who smoked while they were pregnant. Oregon is in the yellow line, and the U.S. in the green line. And you can see that we were above the national rate for quite some time, and we got pretty close down to the national rate around 2001. Again, once the funding cuts went into place, we have seen erosion of those gains, and particularly dramatically in this area, to me, the rates of pregnant women smoking have continued to decline in the rest of the country, whereas in Oregon they have actually increased. So this is of great concern to us and has immediate effects on health care costs.
Dr. E said there were 94,000, I think it was, fewer smokers in Oregon, but yet you didn't see that the mothers were not included in that 94,000. It's just, who was that population? Who were those people?
Chair Carter, that did include the moms who were not smoky anymore as well. But there still are a substantial number of moms who do smoke.
Okay. Senator Johnson, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that you've gone back to that 94,000, how do you track that data? How do you know there are 94,000 fewer smokers?
Chair Carter, Representative Johnson. Senator Johnson.
Senator.
I'm sorry.
She's just on the House side at the moment.
These numbers are based on the largely on the survey data that we collect from Oregonians, and we get information about their smoking habits in a variety of ways, including whether they have stopped smoking or not.
Thanks.
Now, by comparison, I think it's useful to look at a place where funding has been sustained, and not only sustained, but actually is at a level that's recommended by the CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control. I'll talk a little more about that in just a second. But what you can see, this graph shows cigarette smoking among eighth graders in Oregon from 1996 to 2006. And you can see Washington in the white line below has had a continued and sustained decline. And again, Oregon in yellow, we were doing pretty well for a while, but again, have started to see those numbers tick up again. Okay, so that's the past. Let's talk about the future. You know, tobacco is a product that is very actively marketed by the tobacco industry. And they spend an awful lot of money doing that. This chart shows the light blue line up above, the expenditures that are estimated for big tobacco just for marketing here in Oregon. Now compare that with the brown line that's almost so low you can hardly see it at the bottom of the graph. That's our TPEP budget. The last point in the graph, incidentally, is what's been proposed in the governor's budget, the $34 million figure. I also have on this graph, to the right of the graph, a little bar that shows what the Centers for Disease Control recommends. With this increase in funding, we'll still be just a little bit below that minimum, but very close to it, certainly a lot better than we are right now. So one way of looking at whether or not this is an appropriate investment of these dollars is to compare the kind of money that's being spent pushing tobacco use on people.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just your comment about what tobacco companies spend. I'm going to pass around something that I collected over the weekend. This is some information produced by Philip Morris, basically saying you should not support House Bill 2201. This is tobacco dollars at work, but you might want to see that. Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It begs a more fundamental question for me, and I'm leaping ahead in your presentation, I'm sure. But I care a lot less about the budget as a fraction of the tobacco expenditure. I want to know what we're buying for the money.
Right.
And the fact that we don't compare favorably with CDC doesn't move me as much as I want some concrete demonstration of what's the bang for the dollar expended when we're talking about big dollars and just so many priorities that can be funded. I want to know what we're buying.
Chair Carter, Senator Johnson, I will get to that in a minute. I would say that my point with regard to the CDC minimum for Washington was not that it's the CDC minimum. For some of the comparisons I'm going to make, that's why that's relevant, but that Washington has had sustained funding in the neighborhood of what we are talking about and has produced some results, whereas our results are being threatened. But I will get to your question, I hope. If I don't answer it, please ask me again. Okay. Another way to look at this would be to compare the TPEP budget to tobacco-related health care costs. This is a huge big-ticket item for our health care system. It's estimated that tobacco-related illnesses cost Oregon over $2 billion each biennium. So the proposed TPEP budget that you're hearing about is less than 2% of those costs. And then finally, this issue of return on investment. And the reason I talk about the CDC minimum here is because the data that we have on economic effects is pegged to the CDC minimum. It's largely produced by experts in other places who make national who do this at the national level for each state. But if we were funded at the CDC minimum for 5 years, we would expect approximately a 1% drop in youth and adult smoking each year. And that translates into about 27,000 fewer smokers each year. Over the lifetime of these folks who were not smoking, we would reap $2 billion in health care savings. Now, that doesn't all happen immediately. In the next 5 years, it would be about $41 million. But over their lifetime, there would be substantial savings, and that's this issue of the crossing lines that you all have already alluded to earlier. And then finally, this slide just talks about savings from health care that would be prevented. But there are other costs associated as well. There's worksite productivity issues for people who are ill and not at work. And there's prevention of lost productivity from premature death. Those people who die from tobacco-related illnesses are not contributing economically to our communities. And, of course, the human toll of this, again, has already been spoken to, and I don't have data on that. Those are really the prepared remarks that I brought with me. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions. You know, with a decline, with the institution of a tobacco tax, one would expect a decline in consumption simply from increasing the price to some extent, and an additional decline if prevention is invested in, as has been proposed. You know, the estimates, we've worked with the folks in revenue and looked at their estimates, and on the health side, we're very comfortable with the stability of that as a source of funding. Unfortunately, I wish I could say that with this investment that we would eliminate tobacco use tomorrow, but we're not going to get there, and I'll stop with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Roth.
Madam Chair, not a question really yet. I wanted to clear up my previous questions for the benefit of the committee. I do not advocate for smoking. I advocate for smokers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gerard. Representative Cortez, am I missing somebody?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to talk just a second about the unfortunate consequences of not funding our tobacco prevention program. And for me, it's an equity issue across the state. We have been able to fund proven programs in a variety of places in the state, but we are not reaching every school district. We are not reaching every county. And so depending on where you live, you're going to have greater access to those education and cessation programs based on our funding. And I don't know if you could comment on that. I think that's an equity issue that hopefully with an additional investment we can rectify to some degree.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, absolutely. I think this is one of the things that's most difficult about having to make those choices given the limited funds that we had. And you're absolutely right. We cover a pretty small number of school districts around the state and a pretty small number of communities in terms of some of the community coalition works that we do. Our media work does reach, of course, across the state, although probably, well, not probably, for sure, with additional funds, we would be more aggressive about getting to some of the smaller areas of the state that may not be reached in quite the same way or quite as effectively. And similarly, reaching populations that are disproportionately affected by tobacco use. We know, for example, but in the African American community, tobacco use is about 1.5 times what it is in the state as a whole. In the American Indian community, it's more than 2 times what it is in the state as a whole. And that requires some special attention from us. So we're doing some of that already. With additional funding, we would be doing that better and more. Absolutely.
Can I follow up on that, please?
One more, and then we'll go back here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the point that the success we've had in the state has, my impression, is from using a multiple set of approaches. It's not just advertising. You know, you physically need bodies working in these communities to do this. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair Carter, Representative Kotek. There's a lot of good research data as well as our own experience that supports the idea that it's a comprehensive program, and by that I mean that people hear the messages about not smoking from all around them. You know, if you go to see the doctor and the doctor tells you to stop smoking, well, I know, of course, if I was your doctor, you would all listen to me, you know, to the last word every minute of the day. But the fact is...
Must be doing something wrong.
But the fact is that, you know, you might listen for a little while, but the truth is probably that message would wear off. But then you get in your car and you drive to work and you hear an ad on the radio about the danger of smoking, and you get to work and there's a policy in place that makes it more difficult for you to smoke, and you get home and your wife says, you know, honey, please go outside to smoke, I can't stand that, and your kids who learned about it in school start razzing you about smoking. It's all of those, hearing the message in all that, those different ways, that starts to really change behavior. So we believe very strongly in a comprehensive program, and the way that we would use these increased funds would be to beef up across the board all of the components of our program. We would do this in line with the recommended best practices from the Centers for Disease Control. That's what we've always tried to abide by as best we can given the funding that we've got, and we would continue to do that.
Thank you.
Senator Morse. I yield my time to Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Doctor, we're going to be asked to prioritize our spending across a number of areas with scarce resources. I mean, the economy's improved, but we don't have enough money to buy everything we want. I'd like you to give me, if you can, either now or later, some real data on just how successful those compelling ads featuring the two cowboys were. I miss my lung, Bob, is my personal favorite. Could you explain how efficacious that campaign was?
Chair Carter, Senator Johnson, it's not possible to provide effectiveness data on just one component of our program, because what we know is that alone, and none of those components is going to be terribly effective in the long run. But when they're done together, they have a substantial impact.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
You may.
The other thing that I'd be very curious about is, as you track costs of the various components of your program, if you could track overhead to the ad agencies that were producing those and buying the media buys, and certainly that data was tracked.
Chair Carter, Senator Johnson, absolutely. I'd be happy to provide that information to you.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I remember when I was in college when I did smoke occasionally, but I didn't inhale.
Thank you.
Just wanted to make that clear. But the picture of the guy who was the most popular poster in the dorm at UW was that old man who was gurning, his lip was turned inside. Does anybody remember that? And it was, he'd lost his face from smoking, basically. But, I mean, we all joke about when he had a cigarette in there, but it was the most popular poster, and a lot of people just thought, whoa, is that what's going to happen to me? So I quit immediately, just like that.
Appreciate your comment today, Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we hear from Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your courtesy, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, I have two things to hand out to you today. The first is written by Mazen Malik, who's an economist with the Legislative Revenue Office. I'm going to hand out his staff measure summary and also the revenue impact statement that has been issued on House Bill 2201A engrossed version. So I'll do that right now. Thank you, Eric. The second thing I want to hand out is a very high-level summary of House Bill 2201-A engrossed. Our intention this afternoon was to give members of the subcommittee a pretty good view of what was in the governor's recommended budget as far as the Healthy Kids program, and then to talk a little bit about how the A engrossed version has changed what was in the governor's budget a little bit. So I'll hand that out as well.
you.
I'm going off the sheet that I prepared, which is the bulleted list. The House Revenue Committee made or adopted seven amendments to the original version of the bill. That amended version then was printed and is the A engrossed version of the bill. Obviously, the first two bullet points on here is that it does implement the Oregon Healthy Kids Program. I hope you all know that by now. Secondly, it increases the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products and produces revenue from that increased tax. Now, to the changes to the original version of House Bill 2201, and I will try and point to page numbers as I go through. The first bullet was the Dash 10 amendment to the original version of the bill. It implements a cigarette inventory tax, which was not in the original version of the bill, and it synchronizes the timing of that floor tax with the cigarette sales tax. And this was a question that Representative Morgan asked. It times those up together to begin on October 1st, assuming that the Assembly adjourns by June 30th, 2007. So the bill implements this tax, both the floor tax and the sales tax, on the 91st day on the first day of the calendar month following the 91st day after the session ends.
So, John, the floor tax, in terms of Measure 44, was a one-time tax for that particular period of time in terms of the floor tax, not the overall of the overarching issue regarding cigarette tax.
Madam Chair, the inventory tax in the engrossed version of the bill, dealers of the cigarettes are required to take an inventory and to purchase stamps for those cigarette packs that are in inventory and to stamp those things. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, the inventory tax was not part of the original bill. It is in the engrossed version.
Okay. But just again, for personal clarification, Madam Chair, the inventory tax is just something to get all of the cigarettes and tobacco products that are currently in the system but unstamped stamped.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, it only does cigarettes. It is not a stamp on other tobacco products. There is no inventory or floor tax on the other tobacco products, but otherwise the answer to your question is yes.
So the floor tax will be a one-time piece of it.
Yes,
thank you.
That's correct. The second bullet point was the Dash 12 amendment to the original bill. It reduced the eligibility for Office of Private Health Partnerships premium subsidies for households with incomes of 350% of the federal poverty level, which was what Ms. Kelly Seal talked to us. Aaron Kelly Seal talked about a moment ago, down to 300% of the federal poverty level. Third bullet point is that it added eligibility requirements for the Office of Private Health Partnerships component of Healthy Kids. It added a durational residency requirement of 180 days. Senator Gordley had questions about that, which I tried to respond to. And secondly, a requirement that the office must adopt verification procedures to ensure that recipients of OPHP Healthy Kids coverage are legal residents of Oregon.
Senator, did you have further questions on that?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
During the House discussion on the measure, what was the discussion around the durational residency requirement, and was there an awareness that, as you pointed out, Mr. Britton, that such a requirement could be contrary to Medicaid law and that there would be issues with a constitutional challenge?
Madam Chair and Senator Gourley, I don't know what the awareness of the committee was, and I didn't follow that discussion about the durational residency requirement.
And I can't speak for the entire, I wasn't at the Revenue Committee meeting, but my understanding was it was trying to address an issue that some people had raised about families coming from other states to immediately enroll their child. Clearly we have an issue with it, but I think that was part of the intent to address that issue, whether it was an accurate concern or not. I think there was some effort to address it.
Representative Boone? I just wondered if it was discussed, I see where it was discussed that cigars be taxed, but what about snus? Was that discussed?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, I don't know.
Would it be possible for us to get some clarification around whether any residency requirement is legal or constitutional or none is, or what the shape of that is?
Thank you, Representative Morgan. We plan to have counsel here when we work it, and right now what John and Storm is just going over and talking to you about the changes as it relates to the AMGO's version versus the original bill itself. But when we go into work session, which I plan to do sometime next week, and we'll let you know what date we're going to do that, we'll make sure that Ledge Council is here as well.
Thank you.
Senator Morrison, I'm saying?
Okay.
Madam Chair, quick answer to Representative Morgan's question would be this, and I would defer to Legislative Council, but currently to receive public welfare programs or to be eligible for public welfare programs offered through the Department of Human Services, there is a requirement that a person be an Oregon resident. It's the durational part of this that causes problems.
Mm-hmm. So what is an Oregon resident right now? What's the definition?
Again, I would defer to counsel, but it's somebody who intends to be here on a permanent basis. And that may not be quite accurate. Again, Ms. Freeman down at counsel should answer that question. I'm now on, I think, the fourth bullet point. It added... The A and Gross version adds two services to the Oregon Healthy Kids program, a statewide Healthy Kids advice line and a statewide Healthy Kids access line, and those are mentioned in section 2 at the top of page 2 of the printed A and Gross version of the bill. Next bullet down was the Dash 17 amendment. It requires the Office of Private Health Partnerships to contract with community health centers and safety net clinics to provide health care services to children who are not enrolled in a health benefit plan.
I'm sorry.
Going back to the statewide Healthy Kids advice line, was there a discussion of liability on this advice line? If advice is given over the line about a child and outcome is resulting from that that's negative, is the state or the line liable for medical malpractice?
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, I don't know that there was a discussion of the liability.
Maybe we can find that out.
We will have counsel here. That's a great question.
The second to last bullet was the Dash 18 amendment. It really did two things generally. Established a mechanism for distributing newly generated tobacco tax revenue to a Healthy Kids program and also to the tobacco use reduction account. In the original version of the bill, that particular section was blank. There were no percentages, and that was left to the House Revenue Committee. And you can look at that in sections 20, 25C, and 25D. I would also point out that it modified the existing distribution of tobacco tax revenue in order to maintain tobacco tax revenue flows to the general fund, to the Oregon Health Plan, and to local governmental entities.
And the purpose of that was to hold all of those pieces of state programs harmless as far as adding more tax and thereby reducing consumption. So those other pieces that are already receiving tobacco tax will receive approximately what they would otherwise receive. Finally, the bill requires that revenue allocated to the tobacco use reduction account is used to fund tobacco use prevention and education programs that are recommended in the best practices for comprehensive tobacco control programs. And I think Dr. Cohn alluded to the fact state minimum funding standards, and that is what is in this, along with a discussion of what best practices are as far as prevention and education programs. So this makes or requires the department to use funds in recommended ways in the best practices program. And just to close, I would be happy to meet with any of you on an individual basis if you'd like to talk about the reverse version of the bill, as I'm sure any of the presenters would be who made presentations today.
Thank you. Question for John, Representative Cotet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, John, the table we received about the three-year uptake, this is A engrossed? In terms of the items that are included in 2201?
Not quite. And I need to find it. Representative Kotek, you're talking about the piece that Aaron Kelly Seal handed out.
So mine is school-based health centers, anything above tobacco use and above,
yes.
School-based.
2201 specifically targets healthy kids, so that is the DHS piece, OPHP. It does establish a continuously appropriated allocation to the Department of Revenue. The school-based health clinics are not specifically mentioned in House Bill 2201, nor are the other pieces below the tobacco use reduction account on this page. They are, however, parts of the governor's recommended budget, but they're not in 2201.
Thank you for the clarification. Other questions? You guys have been so good today. Thank you so very much for your participation and cooperation and how we were able to respond to the panels, and I hope that you have clarification. We look forward to a good work session. Bring your questions the next time as well. We have legislative counsel here to answer some of the technical questions that you want to have asked as well. Thank you very much, and thank you, audience, for being a participant with us today.